Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, helping neighbors invest in neighbors to realize their dreams of affordable homeownership and small business growth. More details at communityloanfund.org/radio.
This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Lawmakers have released a 12-page report detailing how failures by the state's top child protection agency contributed to a crisis at the Sununu Youth Services Center. Leaders from the Division for Children and Family Services are scheduled to tell lawmakers today how they're responding to that report's findings. And NHPR's Anne-Marie Timmons has been following the story, and she joins us now over Zoom. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning, Rick.
We've been following this investigation since new allegations of abuse were first disclosed by the Office of the Child Advocate back in March. Now, before we dive into this report, can you remind us of what sparked this investigation?
Yeah, there were two things. Children and staff were reporting that administration had put an extended lockdown in place that kept children initially just in their rooms, and then a couple of weeks later, they could go among their units for weeks. And during this time, they had very limited access to the school and the gym and the cafeteria. The report said that when children had to leave a unit during this time, they were shackled. And children described it actually as feeling like they were in a jail. And around the same time, the Child Advocate's Office received a second report. And in that case, a child had been injured during a restraint. And that very quickly prompted this investigation that led to the report.
Okay, let's get into some of your takeaways from this report. Where would you start with this, Anne-Marie?
I think there were a few big ones. I guess I would start with the Office of the Child Advocate, which is an independent watchdog over the DCYF, the Division for Children, Youth, Families, but also places like the Sununu Center. I think the report made clear that it's serving a very important role, and that's important because last year House Republicans eliminated that office from their budget, saying in a tight budget year, that office wasn't, quote, necessary. The Senate was later able to restore some funding, but it still saw quite a bit of budget cuts. I think the report says very clearly that this committee thinks that that office is not only necessary, but really critical. And it calls for increasing funding to the office, and it also would expand its authority quite a bit over the Division for Children, Youth, and Families and its protection of children. I mean, it would have to issue regular reports to the Child Advocate's Office and really say, then, how are we doing in terms of implementing your recommendations to us? So it'd be quite a change for that office. That was probably what stuck out the most for me. Secondarily, the report also conveys a lack of trust in DCYF by the authors of this report. It really alleges that the leadership of that office provided inconsistent information or sometimes no information. And it noted that the director of the center didn't make himself available for questions, and he has since resigned.
Yeah, something I was really interested in was how lawmakers turned the focus on themselves in this report. They said that their own budget cuts contributed to this.
That's right. Senator Sharon Carson, one of this legislature's top Republicans, heads this oversight commission. And I was surprised to hear this too. Last week when the commission took up this report, she said the legislature's budget cuts have contributed to this crisis. You know, Child Advocates Office had to reduce its supervision visits to the center because it lost almost half its staff. DCYF is down 14 youth counselors. It didn't have the money to cover the education costs at the Sununu Center. So she really said that we and the public needs to understand that we need to fund these agencies if we want them to protect children.
And back in 2023, lawmakers also passed a law that required DCYF to ensure the youth detention center was operating under what they call the therapeutic trauma-informed approach. And I assume this report finds that this is not what's actually happening.
That's correct. And we heard this again and again throughout the weeks that the investigative committee was questioning people, and they did this all in public. Lawmakers kept saying, this law was not a suggestion, it was the law. But the report finds that that's not happening, that it's kind of more of a corrections-minded setting than a therapeutic setting. So the report calls for staff training that focus on de-escalating situations. Current training includes military-style tactics like takedowns. It also recommends returning therapy animals to the facility, focusing on teaching children life skills because they do leave this facility, and also moving from what they see as a very punishment-focused system to more of a reward system.
Are lawmakers considering any consequences for DCOAF, given the lawmakers don't think that the agency has been following this law?
Yes, and it could be significant. I think all of that really very candid frustration on lawmakers saying this bill, this law wasn't a suggestion, has led to this particular potential consequences. Lawmakers want to be able to withhold funding from DCIF if it does not start implementing that law. And it's given them until next month to say these are all the things we're going to do to implement it. So that quite a bit of supervision on DCIF now, and a real threat to lose even more funding.
So the commission of lawmakers who released this report are meeting this morning. They've asked DCOAF to attend and respond to the report. What are you watching for, Anne-Marie?
I think this report does give DCOAF a lot to address, and so far we've not heard a lot from them. Initially, they said the Attorney General's office is also investigating, so we can't address a lot of this. They have since said a lot of this isn't true in our mind. So really, I'm wondering how the DCOAF is going to talk about the lockdown. What did that look like? And what is the climate and culture in there? Do they feel there is a therapeutic approach being taken, or does it need to change?
I want to turn to another story that you reported on this weekend, Marie. Former State Senator Andy Sanborn has agreed to plead guilty to misusing $250,000 in federal pandemic aid intended for his business. You've been covering this since the allegations of fraud against him were made public years ago. Is he facing time in prison for this?
He is. He could face up to 10 years in prison. I don't think we'll see that because prosecutors have indicated that they'll recommend he spend a year and a day in prison instead in exchange for the plea deal.
Now, I know documents in the Attorney General's case against him show that Sanborn spent some of the pandemic aid on a Ferrari for his wife, former state rep Lori Sanborn. Are there any federal allegations related to her?
There have not been any charges or even a hint of charges that I've heard against her. But this plea deal says this would resolve any potential criminal liability that could come up. So don't expect to see anything from Lori Sanborn for Lori. But I also do want to just clarify that's not been in the discussion so far that she was accused of any wrongdoing.
Okay. Is Sanborn fighting any criminal charges in the state's case against him? I know that's separate.
He is. State authorities have charged him with defrauding a different pandemic aid program that the state ran. They said he inflated his losses so that he could get more money. And that case is set for trial early next year. And he's also still fighting to hold on to his casino case. And that's really what started all this. The Attorney General's office said he can't hold a casino license given this alleged fraud.
And NHPR's Anne-Marie Timmons. Anne-Marie, thanks so much for the time this morning.
Thank you.
A proposal to build a data center in the town of Nottingham has been withdrawn after statewide backlash over that plan. NHPR reporter Kate Dario has been reporting on this, and she joins us now over Zoom as well. Good morning, Kate.
Hey, Rick.
Hey, tell us about who was proposing this data center and why.
So the data center was proposed by Thomas Moulton, a Seacoast entrepreneur. He wanted to build a data center off of Route 4 at a vacant property he already owns. He said it could be an economic boon for the town, you know, potentially increasing tax revenue.
Where was Moulton at the stage of this proposal? Was just a very preliminary proposal? Was it far along in the process?
Yeah, it was still pretty early. So this past week on Wednesday, there was an initial meeting between Moulton and the town's planning board scheduled. It would have been like a preliminary consultation. And when I was connecting with the planning board chair over email, he basically told me that the planning board would have been learning at the same time as the public a little bit more about Moulton's plan.
I mentioned that the plan got a lot of criticism, including a petition. Tell us about the concerns there.
Yeah, so there was a petition that garnered more than 25,000 signatures against the data center over the course of only about 5 days. That was the number right before the meeting on Wednesday night. Plus, organizers had scheduled a protest outside of the planning board meeting when Moulton and the planning board would have been having this preliminary consultation. You know, people raised concerns about how the data center could affect the local environment and also the quality of life in town. You know, people were worried about how much water the data center could use and how it could potentially impact negatively local water systems. There were concerns over rising energy costs and also the risk of noise pollution coming from the center.
Yeah. Now, a detail here. I know that Moulton said he could come back with a revised proposal for this. I mean, what does that mean, and how is he responding?
Yeah, so basically he withdrew his application only a couple hours before the meeting on Wednesday, and he said he's going to do more research. He's going to look and see if he can address the concerns that people have raised, if there's a better way to do it, if there's a way to minimize these risks. And he told me basically, like, if it's not the right idea, then they're not going to do it. But also, in a letter sent via his lawyer to the town, they made it clear that he could reintroduce this proposal in the future. They're really gathering more information and seeing if there's a way that could, you know, ignite less controversy to build this center.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it sounds like it could be an ongoing story. I know you'll be following that. On a different story, Kate, you have a story coming up next week for our series, New Hampshire at 250. It's about New Hampshire forests. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so a couple weeks ago, I went out on a hike in the Sheldrick Forest in Wilton, basically to understand how this patch of woods has changed over the past 250 years. It was a preview to a hike that was scheduled for Wilton's like 250th town celebrations.
So you basically went on a hike for work?
Yeah, exactly, good. Exactly.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. I mean, what did you learn about the area that you were going through? I mean, obviously, New Hampshire, you think about New Hampshire, what it's gone through over 250 years, very different scenery.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, New Hampshire is one of the most heavily forested states in the country. And I think you can get tricked sometimes by how many trees are here and sort of imagine that it's always looked this way. But as you hinted at, you know, it has changed a ton. So most of the forest that we were in had been cleared by European settlers when they arrived. Basically, they raised the landscape to have fields for farming. You know, we walked through this really heavily wooded area that had been a major road. It was really interesting. And there was only one patch of trees that had survived the past 250 years undisturbed. I can play a clip. This is Nikki Andrews, who is the forest steward, and she is the person who guided me on this hike.
This tree here is about 250 years old, so this was alive when Washington was. This was a seedling when Washington was alive.
It's fun to think about, isn't it?
Something to think about, exactly, to see something. You know, this was a very tall tree, and I think it really put into perspective kind of, you know, what's been happening on this land over the past 250 years. It's really cool.
And so much of the woods that I hike through on a daily basis are obviously new growth. I mean, they were cleared for, you know, pasture land and so on 150 years ago. And I think about that or for wood. And you see those stone walls in the woods all the time, and you think how different the land was.
Totally, exactly. No, it's a really interesting experience and something that I think is a little hard to wrap your head around sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait for it to hear that story. NHPR's Kate Dario. Kate, thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
I'm Rick Anley, and this is NHPR.